Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the September 8th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is The History of the New Yorker's Vaunted Fact-Checking Department by Zach Helfand. Department of Amplification, The History of the New Yorker's Vaunted Fact-Checking Department. Reporters engage in charm and betrayal. Checkers are in the harm reduction business by Zach Helfand. I turned in this piece with 79 errors. Anna, the fact checker, who fixed them, has been a member of the New Yorker's checking department for 6 years. I enjoy working with Anna, which is good because being checked by Anna involves maybe a dozen hours on the phone. We talk mainly about facts and occasionally about foraging for chanterelles, which is her passion. People sometimes ask Anna if she finds many errors. In the 80s, one checker found that an unedited issue of the magazine contained 1,000 of them. This figure itself wouldn't survive a fact check, but never mind. My contribution to the trash heap in this piece alone included misspelling several proper nouns. Columbia, alas, is not Columbia. Inventing, it seems, a long ago interaction between a fact checker and the deputy prime minister of Israel, and writing about a bird's kidney when I should have been writing about its liver. I'm sure no errors remain, but I won't declare it categorically. That kind of thing makes a checker squirm. I encountered a complete description of what the magazine wants its checkers to check. A managing editor took a stab in 1939, points which in the judgment of the head checker need verification. New checkers, upon receiving their first assignment, are instructed to print out the galleys of the piece and underline all the facts. Lines go under almost every word. Names and figures are facts. Commas can be, too. Cartoons, poems, photographs, cover art, full of facts. Opinions aren't facts, but they rely on many. Colors are facts. Recently, a short story by Claire Stasanovich made a passing reference to yellow bird poop. The checker consulted ornithological sources. Would a bird poop yellow? Maybe if it had a liver problem. Fiction is full of facts, sometimes too many. Dates are facts, clothes are facts, actions are facts. Quotes are facts, and they contain them. Facts can be nesting, like a Russian doll. A decade ago, Calvin Tompkins wrote about an artist who said he was getting married on June 21st, the summer solstice. The checker, David Cortava, called the artist, congratulated him, and alerted him that the solstice would be on the 20th that year. The artist moved the wedding date. It's difficult to check facts or to talk about fact-checking without coming off as a know-it-all, a fussbudget, or a snob. But knowing things is hard. Checking is a practice. It's not omniscience. 2 years ago, Amanda Prusich wrote a piece on the band The National, in which she described two of its members, Bryce and Aaron Dresner, as identical twins. The brothers look identical, but to be safe, the checker checked with Bryce. Confirmed, story went out. Complaint came in. Aaron said sorry, but they are not identical. Could the sentence be corrected to read fraternal twins? The checker convened the brothers in a group text. Bryce, we were never tested, but our mom thinks we are identical. Smiley face. Aaron, seconds later. Our mom says we are fraternal, but truth be told, we have never been tested. In the face of uncertainty, you say what you know. A correction ran describing the Dresners as simply twins. When I joined the department, I assumed that you'd be fired for an error. I had one on the first long piece that I checked solo, a misidentified art donor. I got to my cubicle the following morning, ready to pack up my belongings. I told the checkers sitting near me what had happened. Everyone nodded and went back to work. I'd interviewed for the job 3 times. Midway through, 3 checkers administered what is known as the checking quiz. Trivia questions, essentially on current events. Art, politics. What did the case Marbury versus Madison establish? Who wrote the short story on which Drive My Car is based? Can you name the state and non-state actors fighting in the Syrian war? In the 60s, there was a written exam. One section presented the candidate with a sample talk of the town passage about an art collector. He is a member of the Yale Club, Racquet and Tennis, and the Exclusive Union League. He is an ardent Democrat. Question, what do you find in it that is questionable or wrong? A, he would not belong to the Union League Club because he is a Democrat, and it is not exclusive at all. The quiz's function remains ambiguous. I assume it's to assess general knowledge and the ability to think under pressure, but it might be just for kicks. For years, candidates were asked, what is the best movie of all time? A reasonable person says, Uncheckable, no answer. But there was an answer. Sunset Boulevard. Martin Baron, a long time head of the department, loved Sunset Boulevard. The belief among the rank and file was that you want to do very well on the quiz, but not ace it. A know-it-all is susceptible to overconfidence. A checker named Shireen Khalid recently said to me, no one ever grows up wanting to be a fact checker. Most arrive hoping to be writers or editors. For me, joining the department felt like an initiation. There were secret histories, late nights, and weird customs, though fewer than there used to be. A former checker once visited the office and said, do you still have Friday afternoon theatricals? This was the most diverse group of anal retentive people I've ever been around, if you forget about political persuasion and age. Checkers had grown up poor and grown up with billions. They came from New Orleans and Nanjing. The heterogeneity surprises people. Tucker Carlson asked a checker, Sean Lavery, which high school he had attended, Andover or Exeter. I said I went to public school in Wisconsin. Lavery recalled, checkers of my era, their number grew from 20 to 25 during my three-year tenure, collectively spoke 15 languages, including Urdu, Cantonese, Japanese, Arabic, Greek, Russian, and Twi, with a working knowledge of ancient Greek and Latin. They wore cool clothes. They'd read all of Proust. They'd married young and divorced. They threw fun parties. Salman Rushdie had once shown up. I had never felt so conventional. The joke in the department was that my foreign language was sports. The head of the department and Baron's successor was Peter Canby. He'd come to the magazine by accident. He had previously spent a while in Maine working as a clammer and a tree surgeon. As a boss, Canby was exceptionally kind and protective, a joyful curmudgeon. He once brought a live rooster to the office of Roger Gottlieb, the magazine's editor. He liked to tell discursive stories about being chased up a tree by a herd of wild peccaries in Guatemala or lowering a handmade boat out of a friend's window downtown and sailing it together up the East River through Hell's Gate. Under his leadership, the department cultivated a sense of independence that could be combative. Shortly before Canby retired in 2020, someone wrote to him suggesting that the checkers might like to use a new application called Slack. He responded, the collective opinion is that we'd rather have a root canal. A joy of the job was that you became an expert for 2 weeks on some subject you'd never thought much about, rocket science, foreskin, sand. Suddenly, the writer gets this paid friend to care about the same thing they care about, Rachel Aviv observed. We'd send around emails with subject lines like, anybody ever been a competitive rower? Anybody well-versed in the history of young, heavily scrutinized female celebrities? Anybody happen to have an in with the Gabonese president? The focal point of the department was the checking library, which contained reference books such as Who's Who in the People's Republic of China, Debrett's Peerage and Baronage, and the Physician's Desk Reference for Herbal Medicines. New checkers are advised that you can't trust books. They tend not to be fact-checked. But reference works help, and endnotes are a goldmine. The library had another relic, a metal Rolodex that Calvin Trillin has said belongs in the Smithsonian, under C. Chomsky, Cher, actress, Congo, Cold Fusion. Every Friday, the department held a meeting in the library where checkers discussed thorny stories and bitched about difficult writers and editors. There was a smaller library for even more books. Checkers, on especially tight deadlines, would spend the night on a cushion on the floor. Colleagues would talk for hours with the powerful and the secretive. A conversation with Julian Assange required technological methods that we were not permitted to discuss to discourage eavesdropping. Yasmin Al-Sayed, got propositioned by Islamic militants. Fergus McIntosh, the department's current head, got book recommendations from a Supreme Court justice. Danyoung Kim would come to work in an astronaut costume, sit down, and call up Harry Reid. "We probably took our jobs too seriously." This was the first Trump administration, and the work felt urgent but doable. "We talked to cabinet members and to neo-Nazis. We'd sometimes get threatened, and that only inflated our self-importance. We were, as the writer and former Checker David Kirkpatrick has put it, intoxicated by our own busyness." The writer had already engaged in the charm and betrayal inherent in reporting. We were in the harm reduction business. The Checking origin story goes like this. In 1927, The New Yorker published a profile of the poet Edna St. Vincent Millay that was, to a large extent, made up. Millay's mother stormed into the office, threatening a lawsuit. Harold Ross, the former magazine's founder, dispatched the editor, Catherine Engel, to pacify her. Millay's mother was a rather small, angry woman. Engel recalled and left only after being promised that a detailed correction would be issued. Ross, embarrassed and worried about libel exposure, decided what he needed were fact checkers. This creation myth has been repeated throughout the years in books, news stories, and the magazine itself. Alas, it is one of those slippery facts. Who knows what made Ross do anything? If it weren't Millay, it would have been something else. Ross had a literal mind. He once complained to E.B. White that Stuart Little should have been adopted by the Littles rather than born to them, since obviously humans can't conceive mouse boys. He revered facts. He'd been gathering them and checking them long before there was a checking department. John Cheever recalled that Ross made two small but brilliant suggestions to the story, the enormous radio. Cheever added, "Then there were 29 other suggestions like, the story has gone on for 24 hours and no one has eaten anything." Fact-checking as a formal concept was a product of 1920s New York, with all its energy and hubris. There was a sense that with enough attention, you could get the world down accurately on the page. In 1923, 2 years before the New Yorker's founding, Henry Luce began to employ checkers at Time, a magazine he'd almost named Facts. Ross despised and envied Luce. Perhaps checking was an area in which he could outdo him. Ross was a high school dropout and an itinerant newsman who liked shouting things like, "By God," and "You can't win." Facts gave him something to lord over the Ivy Boys. When a fact roused his suspicion, he'd write up a memo with comments like, "Bourgeois," "Nuts," or "Transcends credulence." A favorite note was, "Given facts, we'll fix." According to the writer Brendan Gill, the impression conveyed by these words was, and was intended to be, that a sorely tired man of superior skills was consenting to improve the work of someone who was at best lazy and at worst an imbecile. Ross wrote to a writer who committed a minor fact error, "I regard this as a personal slight." The writer had mixed up the geography of some locks in the Panama Canal. While preparing John Hershey's Hiroshima, Ross couldn't get past Hershey's description of a man using a slender bamboo pole to row a boat. "By God, if it's very slender, he wouldn't have rowed this boat with it," Ross wrote. "Seems kind of ridiculous." The line ran as "thick bamboo pole," and Ross moved on to other facts, such as the name Hiroshima itself, which I can now pronounce in a new and fancy way, he wrote ecstatically to White. The early magazine was riddled with mistakes. The New Yorker was known for its news breaks, which mocked other publications' errors and oddities. In 1929,
included, "We're running misprints and clumsy wordings from other publications and otherwise being godlike, so we must be damn near pure ourselves." Soon there were several full-time checkers. When the magazine profiled Luce and wanted to confirm the number of rooms in his mansion, a checker was sent there to pose as a prospective renter.
I was delighted by the new arrangement and firing off memos. Can moles see? And do they ever come above ground of their own volition? Can you find out whether or not there is a Podunk River in Connecticut? Do the catalogs of Sears and Montgomery Ward still list farm and stock whips, drovers' whips, and quirts? What Ross gave to the checkers was the idea that it mattered to understand the world in all its weirdness, also a willingness to admit ignorance. He once propped his head into the checkers' room and asked, "Is Moby Dick the whale or the man?" Ross was never satisfied with his creation. He must have set up a dozen different systems during my years with him for keeping track of manuscripts and verifying facts, James Thurber wrote. Ross studied the New York Telephone Company's systems of checking names and phone numbers and concluded that, despite its best efforts, it never managed to put out a directory with fewer than three mistakes. Thurber continued, if the slightest thing went wrong, he would bawl, "The system's fallen down." How do you confirm a fact? You ask over and over, how do we know? Years ago, John McPhee wrote about a Japanese incendiary balloon that during the Second World War floated across the Pacific and struck an electrical cable serving a top-secret nuclear site. A reactor that enriched plutonium for the atomic bomb bound for Nagasaki was temporarily disabled. How did McPhee know? Someone had told him. How did that person know? He'd heard about it secondhand. The checker, Sarah Lippincott, spent weeks trying to track down the original source. Just before the magazine went to the printer, she got a lead. She called the source at home in Florida. He was at the mall, how to locate him in time. She called the police. They found him and put him in a phone booth. Did he know about the incident? He did. How? He was the rector's site manager. He saw it happen. The detail made it in. Sometimes one source isn't enough, sometimes 10 aren't. Checking is a forced humility. The longer you check, the more you doubt what you think you know. We are constantly misunderstanding one another, often literally. In the 90s, the former Secretary of Education, William Bennett, a family values Republican and the editor of an anthology called The Book of Virtues, uttered the phrase, a real us and them kind of thing. It was misheard as a real S&M kind of thing. The magazine had to issue a correction. People also lie, regret, renounce. One subject of a Rafi Khachaturian piece complained that multiple details about his life were made up and demanded to know what idiot had given Khachaturian the erroneous detail. The idiot was the man himself. The details came from his book. A disputatious source is actually more helpful than the opposite. The checking system, like the justice system, requires something to push against. When Parker Henry checked Parker Radden Keefe's profile of Anthony Bourdain, Bourdain wasn't able to get on the phone, so Henry sent him a memo containing 100 or so facts about some of the most sensitive parts of his life, including his heroin use and the collapse of a romantic relationship. He responded, "Looks good." Checkers talk to virtually all sources in a piece, named and unnamed. They also contact people who are mentioned, even glancingly, whom the writer didn't already speak to, and many people not mentioned in the piece at all. Checkers don't read out quotes or seek approval. Sources can't make changes. They can flag errors, provide context and evidence. The checkers then discusses the points of contention with the writer and the editor. It's an intentionally adversarial process, like a court proceeding. You want to see every side's best case. The editor makes the final call. In a sense, the checker is re-reporting a piece, probing for weak spots, reaching a hand across the gulf of misunderstanding. The checker also asks questions that, in any other situation, might prompt the respondent to wonder if she was experiencing a brain aneurysm. Does the Swedish chef have a unibrow? He actually has two separate eyebrows that come close together above his nose. Could a pecuary chase a human up a tree? Certainly if it's a white-lipped peccary, which is the size of a small bear and prone to a stampede. Zadie Smith once received a call regarding whether, years earlier, at Ian McEwan's birthday party, a butterfly landed on her knee. When a talk piece by Tad Friend described the singer Art Garfunkel waving his arms around, the checker asked Garfunkel to confirm that he had two arms. And Dusty Mortimer Maddox, a former longtime checker, used to say, "The way you fact check is like reading them a bedtime story." She went on, You tell people facts rather than asking them. When fact checkers say, "Is it true that?" they come off sounding like distant attorneys, district attorneys. But sometimes, no matter how much you coo, a subject wants to yell. This also serves a purpose. Nick Palmgarten likes to note that checkers are the fact business and the customer service business. It helps if everyone comes away feeling heard. Peter Canby's philosophy was that it's better for a subject to scream before a piece is published than after, a controlled explosion. Screamers still provide useful information. They're better than ignorers or trolls. Elon Musk once sent back an Imagine Mad Libs-style story, riffing on all the details to be checked. Steve Bannon responded to a checking question with a blank email. Usually checkers are pretty successful at getting people to respond. Checkers are not exactly neutral arbiters, but they're as close as you're going to get. A last chance to argue your case. The Taliban typically plays ball. So does the CIA. The FBI does not. One checker spoke by phone with Osama bin Laden's former Sharia advisor. He asked her to dress for the conversation in accordance with Islamic principles of modesty. Different cultures have different relationships with facts. The French position is that if the author says something happened, it happened. One veteran Chinese journalist quoted an Evan Osnos piece, who had never before experienced fact-checking, said, "I felt like I was in the middle of an ancient ritual." People can be surprisingly honest. Nicholas Niarchos, checking a piece by Ben Taub, called up one of the most powerful smugglers in the Sahel, who cheerfully confirmed every detail, including his trafficking of humans. At the end of the call, he said, "I have one request." Niarchos said, "What is that?" He replied, "I want you to call me something else." "What would you like us to call you?" "I'd like to be called Albert the Gorilla." The request was denied. The real thrill is in having a license to ask as directly as possible about the thing you really want to know. Did Harvey Weinstein commit rape? Did the government know about the massacre? A checker named Camilla Osario once spent months on the phone with a former guerrilla commander who, it turned out, was implicated in a bombing in Colombia that almost killed Osario's mother. A long checking call can be a weirdly intimate space. You ask about mass murderers, traumas, state secrets, often with little preamble. A government official, after a call, once accused a checker of being creepily obsessed with him. So far, Anna has found errors of counting, errors of framing. One quibble with the framing, if you'll allow me, is that you never mention how checkers quibble with the framing. And errors of the too-good-to-check variety. For example, it turns out that Zadie Smith was asked not about a butterfly on her knee, but about a slug on a wine glass. However, it's one thing to know the facts and another to persuade the author. Most writers appreciate having been checked, but resent being checked. Checking makes evident how badly you've misinterpreted the world. It upsets your confidence in your own eyes and ears. Checking is invasive. In the 80s, Janet Malcolm was sued for defamation in a drawn-out case that involved the parsing of her reporting notes. She'd been accused of fabricating quotes. She maintained that she merely stitched quotes together, a journalistic transgression, but ultimately not a legal one. A court ruled in Malcolm's favor. From then on, the checking department required authors to turn over notes, recordings, and transcripts. "It's like someone going through your underwear drawer," Lawrence Wright told me. Checkers can see your shortcuts, your repertorial wheedling, your blind spots. Ben McGrath, another checker turned writer, said, "It's really interesting to realize that these people you've been reading and admiring, there's six errors on every page. And it's not that they're full of shit. It's that this is what every person is like." As a general rule, the better the reporter, the better she gets along with checkers. Jay McInerney, a former checker, once wrote of authors, "They resent you to the degree that they depend on you." McInerney, who wrote Bright Lights, Big City, about a fact checker at a lightly fictionalized New Yorker, is probably the most famous former checker. He will admit that he was not a great one. He got fired after about a year when his claim that he could speak French was disproved by a litany of errors he let through in a piece reported from France. "I've written that I'm the first fact checker to get fired," he told me. "I pointed out that checkers hate claims like the first. Nobody's ever fact-checked fact-check me out of it," he said. "Why don't you just write it and see what the fact-checking department says?" The department ransacked the archives and searched for checking rosters and concluded that his assertion is nearly impossible to confidently confirm. Like customer service bots or HR directors, checkers and writers talk about things. They'd perform a delicate linguistic dance. At an exhausting stalemate on a minor point, the writer might say, "I think it's okay," which means, "I know it's not exactly correct, but you're being a prig." The checker might respond, "It won't keep me up at night," which means, "You're a barbarian, but it's your name on the piece." Deaf checkers position themselves as collaborators. In a closing meeting where the writer, editor, checker, and copy editor go over a piece, they come not just with errors, but with solutions. Writers hate to be embarrassed by their own ignorance. Anna has a good ear for rhythm and tends to cringe when left with no choice but to scramble it. Her negotiation style is disarming bluntness. It helps that she's funny. "Anna, do you have a fix here? Zach, I had one, didn't I? Anna, it wasn't very good." The nuclear option is to invoke "on author," which signifies something impossible to verify but witnessed or experienced by the author, and therefore grudgingly allowed by the checker, who renounces all culpability. Julian Barnes once explained, if, for example, the fact checkers are trying to confirm that dream about hamsters which your grandfather had on the night Hitler invaded Poland, a dream never written down but conveyed personally to you on the old boy's knee, a dream of which, since your grandfather's death, you are the sole repository, and if the fact checker, having had all your grandfather's living associates up against a wall and having scoured dictionaries of the unconscious without success, finally admit they are stumped, then you murmur soothingly down the transatlantic phone, "I think you can put that on author." One compromise is the hedge, phrases such as "likely" or "around" or "something like," which turn the game of dictional darts into a round of horseshoes. Writers resent the maybe and at least and almost that pock their prose like pimples, but perhaps not as much as they'd resent losing the material. Years ago, the magazine excerpted Ian Fraser's book, Travels in Siberia, which was supposed to begin, "There is no such place as Siberia." The checker insisted upon, officially, "There is no such place in Siberia." "I ended up not totally happy with it, but not regretting it," Fraser said. That kind of fact-checking wasn't nitpicking and wasn't just a bureaucratic thing. It was an artistic advance of the 20th century. It just clicked with modernism. He went on, "Modernism is goodbye to self-expression, hello to what's right in front of you, and that means you better get the thing right. The hedge is an acceptance that the world is impossible to know accurately. It imparts to the writing a humbleness, an understatedness, and perhaps a smug fussiness. In other words, what people think of as the New Yorker's voice. Still, the hedges irritate." One checker, upon leaving the magazine, wrote a goodbye email saying, "After 5 years, I'm still fully in awe of the magazine that comes out every week." Tad Friend replied all, "As the magazine comes out 46 times a year, can we say almost every week?" Friend was almost right. The actual number was 47. Certain genres accommodate checking better than others. Investigatory works rely on it. Personal histories does too, although this often creates complications. One checker called checking a memoir the full colonoscopy. A colleague had to call up Emily Gould, whose husband, Keith Gessen, had written an essay about the birth of their first child. He describes a geyser of blood effusing from his wife during labor. The checker asked Gould about the purported effluence. Gould ended the conversation. Humor can short-circuit the checking machinery. When a humorist and a checker click, they stick together. Anne Stringfield used to check Steve Martin's shouts and murmurs. They ended up married. Usually things go the other way. I once took part in a closing meeting during which we debated for 10 minutes whether Michael Shulman's use of the phrase "assless chaps" was redundant and meaningless. Technically speaking, all chaps are assless. I find that often a fact checker forces you to tie a knot in the sentence unnecessarily, David Sedaris told me. One of his essays describes a trip to a small town Costco where he bought a gross of condoms. The checker said that actually he hadn't. Costco doesn't sell a gross, which is 144. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. So I made it a mess of condoms, which just made them sound used, he said. If the essay was about how many condoms Costco sells, definitely have the exact number. But this was about my experience being gay in a small southern town. Can you let me have this? Humorous can infuriate the checkers who recognize that even funny nonfiction has to be completely real. It's held to the same standard as anything else. Last year, Jane Bua checked a Sedaris essay about meeting the Pope. She checked a detail about the color of the buttons on a cardinal's cassock so assiduously the department's perception, or maddeningly, Sedaris's, that he emailed his editor. Can you slip her a sedative? Sedaris has complained. Checking is like being fucked in the ass by a hot thermos. Bua mentioned this to the checker on Sedaris's next piece. You know, she. She considered the analogy and said, if a thermos works, the outside wouldn't be hot. Like darkness retreats or ayahuasca, checking tends to alter the way you think. It's also usually enjoyed for a limited time. A few make a career of it. One of the first hires Harold Ross made for the checking department in 1929 was a man named Freddie Packard. Packard initially worked under Roger Whittaker. After Packard missed a boner, as an error was called, Whittaker forced Packard to memorize and recite the gallery page. Ross esteemed Packard and relied on him. He also started him on a salary equivalent to about $29,000 today. Checking salaries remained borderline unlivable until the magazine staff unionized in 2018. Packard left for Europe during the war. Ross begged him to return. Job wide open. Stop. Ross wired. Are you available? Stop. Can pay more than formerly. Stop. Packard became the first real head of fact-checking, a position he held until shortly before his death in 1974. That's a long time checking facts. There are many checkers today in the Packard mold. He spoke multiple languages. He commanded a vast sphere of knowledge. He lived in fear that around every corner loomed catastrophe. One week, a colleague noticed Packard moping around the office and asked what was wrong. Packard said he had two colds. Perhaps the most revered of all checkers was Martin Barron, who put in 36 years. Barron was gentle, fatherly, and prim. Alex Ross once wrote a piece mentioning a minor Mozart canon titled Lech Mich im Arch. Barron stayed up late combing through Mozart biographies so he wouldn't have to call a Mozart scholar and repeat the phrase, lick me in the ass. He was almost pathologically punctilious. The checkers loved Barron. He'd bestow upon them honorifics, as in Professor Sigelman or Dr. Kelly. He felt that as a checker, he should avoid errors at all times. John McPhee said, somebody told me the thing you've got to know about Martin Barron, he is always right, and take that literally. If a Shakespeare play was mentioned in a piece, he would have to go and check the author's name. By the end, he'd spent so much time checking that he had difficulty making any assertions at all. He would phrase statements as questions. Wouldn't you say it's a nice day? After Barron's death, Ian Fraser recalled, gesturing to the water below the window, he once said to me, I think that's the Hudson River. The job wears on people in different ways. Some checkers find it difficult to sleep. The novelist Susan Coy, a one-time checker, recalled colleagues vomiting out of stress. In the 90s, everyone smoked cigarettes by the gross. Anna is letting me have this gross. King Zong of Albania reportedly smoked 150 cigarettes daily. It's a job for the anxious. The next boner is always lurking out there in the dark. I was once assigned a piece by Ben Taub that mentioned Lake Victoria 4,000 miles of shoreline. 30 seconds of Googling confirmed the fact, but the exact circumference varied slightly between sources. Why? I contacted Stuart E. Hamilton, a professor of geography and geosciences at Salisbury University. It is a horribly confusing answer and involves physics and fractals, he told me. This is called the coastline paradox, an offshoot of Zeno's paradox. Do not go down that rabbit hole, Hamilton warned. Everything is infinity long if you have a small enough ruler. This is the checker's paradox, too. The more you know that there is more you don't know. The facts of the universe are infinity long. You either let this drive you crazy, or you adjust your ruler size. Taub's detail ran as more than 4,000 miles of jagged shoreline, and I never lost sleep over checking again. Some people greet a New Yorker correction as they would an eclipse. In 1994, several errors appeared in a Talk of the Town piece. The magazine issued a correction, which several publications reported as if it were a seminal event. Henrik Hertzberg went to the library to investigate. This was not the first correction in the magazine's history. It was roughly the 300th, he reported. He added, "Every great journalistic enterprise occasionally makes errors, I can confirm. Since that first correction, I let through some more. I will not name the figure to avoid startling Anna." People like finding errors in the magazine, probably because the magazine is so smug about its fact-checking. Checking does contain an element of theater, a performance of over-the-top diligence that burnishes a myth but doesn't always correlate with accuracy. Checking isn't a marketing ploy, exactly, but it is good marketing. To some, it's just artifice. In the 80s, the writer Alistair Reed admitted to devising composite characters and scenes, combining multiple real details into one fake one. Shouldn't checking have caught that? Afterwards, Michael Kinsley, the editor of the New Republic, wrote of meeting a New Yorker fact-checker at a party. This fellow, a real individual, not a composite, regaled the gathering with tales of chartering airplanes to measure the distance between obscure Asian capitals, sending battalions of Sarah Lawrence girls to count the grains of sand on a particular beach referred to in an Anne Beattie story, and such like tales of heroic valor in the pursuit of perfect accuracy. Kinsley went on, "After several hours in this actually 1 hour, 17 minute, and 53 seconds, he turned to me with a polite smile and said, 'Tell us about your fact-checking system at the New Republic.' I replied, 'You're looking at it.' He turned pale. Actually, he didn't turn pale. I embroider. But he did say, 'That's odd, because if I'm checking a story in the New Yorker and find the fact I need in the New Republic, I consider it checked.'" Complaints reach us in any number of ways. After Lawrence Wright's 24,000-word indictment of the Church of Scientology, the Scientologist published a parody magazine complete with sinister sketches of the fact-checkers and a by-the-numbers analysis of the checking process. Of the 971 statements, assertions, and questions that were sent for fact-checking, 572 are utterly false. Usually, though, errors surface via reader mail. 1947. I was somewhat taken aback to find Mr. Hellman in his article on the Stewart collection announcing the death of my father. To kill off a retired director of the New York Public Library is no doubt as insignificant a misdemeanor as one can commit, but I wonder if it was necessary. 2019. The chicken is not wearing overalls, which you mentioned twice. He is wearing lederhosen. It's the lederhosen that keeps checkers up at night. How, short of a childhood in Bavaria, do you catch that? The corollary is whether it's worth devoting so many resources to trying. Troy told me, "Who cares in the end? Does it really matter? I think we can safely say no." But especially right now, we're in this catastrophic moment where so many people assume they know things that either they don't know or that aren't even forms of knowledge. There's a strange disappearance of humility before the incredible complexity of the world. It's sort of an epidemic. The deep value in checking is just as confirmation of how hard it is to know stuff. The checking department tends to be described with a single adjective, especially after it is committed in error, vaunted. As in this letter, I was disappointed to see the New Yorker's vaunted fact-checker let slip Zach Heflin's bogus etymology for the word tip. Vaunted has been attached to the department and to basically no other entity since its founding. It's the way to give the know-it-alls their due. Often a correspondent will add a sarcastic modifier, once vaunted, much vaunted, incredibly vaunted, which actually isn't necessary. Vaunted, from the Latin vantus, meaning emptiness or nullity, is already pejorative. The know-it-all sniggers. The other thing you get a lot is William Shawn would be turning over in his grave. As a literal fact, this is uncheckable, though the implication that the magazine reached peak truth under Shawn, its second editor, transcends credulence. Shawn was a perfectionist, but given the choice between prose and accuracy, he didn't always side with accuracy. The writer, Ben Yagoda, dug up the checking proofs of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood and found that, beside a section that narrated the actions of a person who was alone and immediately thereafter murdered, Shawn scribbled, "How no?" Yagoda explained. "There was in fact no way to know, but the passage stayed." Meanwhile, Tina Brown's editorship is subject to the opposite impression. She, some critics like to say, was the corrupting influence who let the standard slip. But in many ways, Brown's tenure created the modern checking department. All of a sudden, the magazine was publishing pieces with immediacy and wading into controversial waters. It needed to get the facts right, if only for legal reasons. Millay's mother might yell. Michael Ovitz might sue. Peter Canby and Brown's deputy, Pam McCarthy, were the ones to finally make authors turn over their notes and reveal their sources. Shawn's writers had to adjust. Janet Malcolm, fresh off the trial that probed her combining notes from different interviews, tried the same thing in a passage in her profile of David Sell. McCarthy insisted that she change it. "She's right that it may not matter in the world, that it's more efficient and more pleasing for the reader," McCarthy told me, "but my feeling was that it's impossible to draw those lines." Impressions are difficult to dislodge, probably because they're difficult to check, but checkers come to recognize some category errors. For example, a common fallacy is the belief that things were better in some imagined past. Someone is always spinning in his grave. When Shawn was the editor, he got letters asserting as much about Ross. Ross had no past to contend with. He still got letters. In 1945, a fellow journalist wrote to him, "Now a gentle job for you and your vaunted editorial checkup department, which I admit, however, is pretty damn good and thorough. In the piece, The Atlas Moth, there is a reference to a lunar moth." Of course, the writer means the familiar Luna moth. Ross asked Packard how this could have happened. The checker, in fact, had called a moth expert at the American Museum of Natural History and had misheard. In one way or another, checking is always an S&M kind of thing. Ross was despondent. "I think it is a terribly bad error," he wrote back. "The system is always falling down. The trick is in believing that. Next time, it won't." Heflin is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Weekend essay. Inside the world of the Great British Bake Off. The show captures disastrous custard-making, quintessentially British faux modesty, and the blistering hubris of bakers, including me. By Rudy Tanda. One evening in the autumn of 2012, I got a somewhat urgent phone call from my mom. I was living in a quasi-legal student sublet at the time. The landlord had hooked up the electricity to a streetlight outside, and she wanted to recommend a baking show that might distract me from the rats under the floor. Think Master Chef, but with the pacing of an afternoon spent punting on the Thames. The bakers were normal people, a shop worker, a vicar's wife, a serially competitive 63-year-old Buddhist whose coup de grace was a flock of show pastry cygnets. "There's a Scottish boy on it," my mom added, offering some enticement. "He wears knitted jumpers." In the UK, if you so much as bring a beat-up homemade carrot cake into the office, you can count on somebody telling you to apply for the Great British Bake Off. I was 20 and already had a signature apricot tart recipe, so I was bound to get the call eventually. My mom would, I'm sure, argue that she meant only for me to watch the Bake Off. But you can't watch people doing the thing you love, only worse, and just sit by. Or at least I couldn't. Within a few weeks, I had not only seen every episode, but obsessively studied the format. I took notes when the bakers were challenged to make hand-raised meat pies, a topsy-turvy process in which you make the pastry with hot water instead of cold, and press the dough not into a pie dish, but around the outside of a wooden mold. I acquainted myself with the judges' predilections. The delicate Mary Berry favored the classics, whereas Paul Hollywood, a thoroughly suntanned man, with the alpha saunter of a prison guard, seemed to have a weakness for pina colada-flavored bakes. I wasn't interested in the backstory montages showing the baker's hometowns or in the wholesome conversational patter. That was filler. I wanted the uncensored baking, those sweet shots of gelatine leaking from badly molded pastry. I should probably clear up one thing, which is that my enthusiasm for baking at that point exceeded my expertise. My sense of superiority was mostly speculative. I could probably bake this stuff if I bothered to learn. So I learned. When I should have been reading David Hume, I pored over the writings of Paul Hollywood, that other great empiricist, for his thoughts on dough hydration and oven temperature. I made phyllo pastry from scratch in my room, stretching the dough to the thinness of a page of the King James Bible. What I mean to say, and what any contestant on the show will admit, if they're honest, is that you don't make it into the world of competitive televised baking by accident. I sent in an application in early 2013, attaching photos of Viennese whirls, blackcurrant tarts, and a drum-sized brioche à tête. My repertoire isn't huge, I noted judiciously in the comments, but what it lacks in breadth, I think, is counterbalanced in part by its depth. Midway through the casting process, I sent an email to one of the producers. It's all I've been thinking about, waking up at 4 a.m. to nurse a brioche dough back to life. The producers are used to this. They get people who want the thing so badly that they apply 7, 8, 9 times. During the next couple of months, I inched closer to the show. I cleared interviews with home economists who quizzed me on the finer points of baking technique, how to tell when a meringue was done cooking, or how to get a thin, shattering crust on a loaf of bread. Next were screen tests, a first date with the camera. Toward the end, in-person baking trials. These days, it's not until the thousands of applicants have been whittled to a final 100 that anyone even tastes the bakes. The best amateur bakers in the country is the line, although I get the sense that even the producers don't fully buy this. Throughout the process, we were encouraged to practice, to fill in the gaps in our knowledge, to get up to speed with things outside the amateur repertoire of biscuits and cakes. If any of us were truly skilled at baking, it was often because we had sought out Bake Off, not the other way around. It is hard to think of another show that's screened so carefully, not just for personality type and talent, but also for that more slippery variable purity of intention. Producers find themselves in the position of trying to cast one of the best-known shows on television, one that routinely makes people famous, with people who care about neither television nor fame. They have to sniff out clout chasers and pick through government databases for things like criminal convictions and undeclared baking businesses. Even unrealized dreams can be suspect. When I asked Sophia Reed, the head of casting, about Dylan Bachelet, the Pixar cute 20-year-old retail assistant from season 15, she said she had been nervous about him at first. I knew Dylan wanted to be a chef, she told me. How's that going to land? The show attempts to present Britain in a microcosm, which is why casters have scouted on the street and plugged into Facebook groups. Black dads in London, Irish badminton players, that kind of thing. The Holy Grail is what Reed calls the unlikely baker. To Kieran Smith, the show's executive producer, that's someone like Rahul Mandel, the Winnie the Pooh-esque nuclear scientist from season 9. The moment you get a Rahul, Smith mused, bowing his head, there is someone who is unintentionally funny. There is someone who probably never wanted to be on television in their life. At the very end of the audition process, I was sent to Lynn Greenwood, an impish, curly-haired psychotherapist who has also served as a dowsing rod for shows like The Apprentice. All bakers-to-be must prove to her that they're fit for the rigors of reality TV. I can sniff out someone who's disturbed within a few minutes, Greenwood told me when I visited her recently in the same leafy London neighborhood where we had met 12 years earlier. What she remembers of my assessment, she told me approvingly, was that I was very quiet and not outwardly ambitious, and that I loved baking. I didn't tell her that, from what I recalled, I cried for half the session, constitutionally incapable of playing it cool. That's possibly why, a couple of months later, I was on the show. In the course of the past 15 years, and seemingly by accident, The Great British Bake Off has become one of the most popular TV shows on TV. In its best years, Bake Off has drawn more British viewers than Downton Abbey, Sherlock, Doctor Who, or indeed Prince Philip's Funeral. Paul Hollywood has arguably established himself as the only credible pop culture inheritor of the title of Old Blue Eyes. The show has given us new language. It is now possible for lay people to talk sagaciously about a bake having a soggy bottom. It would have been easy enough for Bake Off to ensnare the food crowd, but it has become a phenomenon even for people who have never touched a stand mixer. In the streaming era, Bake Off is the standard setter for ambivalently watchable TV. A generation of half-watchers turns to it for its gently sedative properties. Meanwhile, bakers watch it for the craft, thinking that maybe next year they'll apply. In recent years, as spin-off shows have proliferated, it's become clear that you can riff on certain incidental details, the British, or say the Bake Off. International franchises have included The Great American Baking Show, an Uruguayan Bake Off, and the lesser-known All of Holland Bakes. We have seen the Great British Sewing Bee, the Great Pottery Throwdown, and the Big Blowout Bake Off for hairstylists. But the original still dominates. Most Brits don't do outright patriotism, so when we deploy phrases like Great British, it is with a certain sardonic flair. The bakers are the kind of people who will be more upset if they accidentally steal someone else's custard than if theirs is the custard being nabbed, as happened in the show, now notorious Custard Gate incident. Occasionally, though, the stealer's survival instincts kick in, and a press baker might be compelled to construct a gingerbread model of the Moulin Rouge on top of a croquembouche. Mix in the pleasurably low-stakes drama of baking, in which nothing rides on success except a baker's pride, and you've struck Comfort TV gold. Even Kylie Jenner is a fan. She posted a video of her watching Bake Off on her jet, calling it my favorite show. Consider the cultural tectonics involved in bringing the extended Kardashian empire into contact with Nelly Gafar from season 15, a flirtatious palliative care assistant from Slovakia by way of Dorset. But this is what makes Bake Off so beloved. It is one of the most successfully unscripted shows of the century and still feels like an underdog. It was 2009 when BBC Two got a pitch from Love Productions for a kind of X Factor for cakes inspired by the Pillsbury Bake Off. Love was in the habit of throwing out ideas like this, a see-what-sticks approach that has resulted in shows like Filthy Rich and Homeless, Rich People Learn Empathy by Sleeping on the Streets, and Cirque du Celebrity. B-list stars learn competitive cord-lisez and the pyrotechnic arts. The company had honed this idea over several years. What if instead of hosting the bake-off in a TV studio, they did it in an English country house? Producers searched for historic manors with the electrical capacity to support 12 ovens and an entire crew. No dice. How about a baking circus comes to town concept, inspired by the judging marquees at English village shows? There would be pastels and bunting. That could put the bakers in a really, really big tent. When it came to finding judges, producers settled on Mary Berry, a cookery writer in her mid-70s and a pioneer of the all-in-one cake method. Instead of creaming butter and sugar together before adding eggs and flour, you blend the whole lot at once. She had been a charismatic champion of the Aga, a brand of British range cooker favored by exactly the people who tend to nuke the competition at village fetes. For her co-judge, they chose Paul Hollywood, at that time a virtually unknown bread baker. He came from a line of bakers and had been the youngest ever head baker at the Dorchester Hotel, but viewers of his cable show, Use Your Loaf, would have known him as the innovator of the breast test. Proof bread dough, when prodded, should feel like a woman's breast. The first episode of The Great British Bake Off aired on BBC Two on August 17, 2010. It's difficult to find the inaugural season to stream now, which may be for the best. Much of the show is given to ponderous historical segues. Passerbys from a nearby village fair peek into the tent, and most of the jokes made by the presenters, the comedians Mel Gilderoy's, and Sue Perkins have been edited out. It wasn't until season three that the show came together. One day, Perkins was filming an introductory segment when she tripped on a divot, worked through the fall, and kept talking like nothing had happened. It was slapstick, not exactly BBC documentary house style, but it worked. Anyone trying to get a reality show off the ground eventually had to reckon with an essentially Shakespearean question. Are we making a play here or a play within a play? Is the format, the set, the show structure, the million contrivances part of the joke? Love decided it was. The Pradol was, in one producer's memory, a small eureka moment. The real Great British Bake Off was born. And that's all we have time for today. Ruby Tando began contributing to The New Yorker in 2020. She is the author of All Consuming, Why We Eat the Way We Eat Now, among other books. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for a new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.